paid commercial program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. This edition has as its backdrop a period rife with significant challenges that go to the very core of effective public management. Faced with seemingly intractable issues such as the ever-growing federal deficit, economic uncertainty, unemployment, and an aging infrastructure, it appears that the old adage, doing more with less, has taken on a whole new reality. Addressing the challenges arising from this new reality brings with it opportunities to try different approaches, borrow new strategies, forego old ways of doing things, and leverage seemingly incongruous practices to ameliorate otherwise vexing problems. Today we've assembled a varied group of leaders, innovators, practitioners, and thinkers who in their own way offer models to follow, provide insights that can infuse theory to practice, and pave the way to shaping the business of government. First up, Conversation with Leaders, featuring dedicated public servants who share their extended reflections on the work they do and the service they perform. Investing in cutting-edge technology is even more important today than ever before. As NASA develops missions of increasing complexity to understand the Earth, our solar system, and the universe, I had the pleasure to speak with Dr. Bobby Braun, chief technologist at NASA, about his efforts to reinvigorate the space technology program and lead the Office of Chief Technologist.
Yeah, the office is new, and the position is new. They were created in February of 2010. There actually was a chief technologist about a decade ago. In the past decade, NASA's research and technology investments have been down a little bit as the agency became more and more mission-focused. And this administration, and frankly the NASA administrator, recognized that. And they wanted to rebuild the research and technology competency, and so they recreated the Office of the Chief Technologist to lead the charge in doing just that. We have two major functions that I'll point out. One is we're responsible for integrating the technology investments across the agency, across the mission directorates at NASA, to make sure that we're doing things in a coordinated and integrated fashion. And then we're also responsible for managing a new budget line that's in the president's budget request for 2011 called the Space Technology Program. In the president's budget request for 2011, that's about $572 million. And over a five-year period, it's about $5 billion for space technology within NASA.
Dr. Braun explains his role and the importance of technology in everything NASA does.
I report to the NASA administrator, and I'm his advisor in all technology matters across the agency. Technology is a part of everything we do at NASA, whether we're talking about aeronautics, science, or exploration. And I take more of a strategic view for the future of the agency and the importance of technology in that future. I'm managing the new space technology program. It's a new approach for technology investments. It's very different than the way NASA has done technology investments in the past. We're building on the lessons learned from organizations like DARPA and ARPA-E, and we're applying that type of model within NASA really for the first time. So it's very exciting.
This excitement has as its genesis a strategic vision that seeks to rebalance near-term mission and far-term technology innovation.
We're actually doing that balance across NASA. The space technology program is focused on those long-term investments. We are investing in a portfolio of technologies that are broadly applicable. And these are technologies that could affect not the next science mission, let's say, or the next exploration mission, but a suite of missions 5 or 10 years from now. Within the mission directorates, within each mission directorate at NASA, and there are four, there's the Aeronautics Mission Directorate, the Science Mission Directorate, the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate, and the Space Operations Mission Directorate. Within those four mission directorates, they invest in what I would call near-term or mission-focused technology. What's been missing is this longer-term or more strategic set of technology investments. And so together, between the new space technology program and the technology programs within the mission directorates, overall, NASA has a good balance between near-term and far-term technology development.
So with such a new and critical mission, what is being done to cultivate a risk-tolerant environment that fosters innovation at NASA? Once again, Dr. Bobby Braun.
Yeah, well, that is incredibly important to what we're doing. What does acceptable risk mean to a technology development program? And this is part of the cultural challenge that I think that I have and that we're working on. The way I view it is we need to have more of a tiered risk acceptance approach to NASA. And as you move into technology development, we certainly need to be able to take more risk. If we don't take risk in our technology development program, well, we certainly won't be developing game changers. The only way I know to innovate is to take risk. The only way I know to make progress towards a grand challenge or to develop a disruptive or game-changing technology is to take some risk. And with risk comes a higher probability of failure. So one of the things that we're doing in the space technology program is we're talking about this. We're saying straight up that we are going to fail. We're not going to fail with every investment. We have a broad portfolio of investments. What's important is that when we fail forward. We learn from that experience. A disruptive technology needs to come in there, and perhaps we skip a couple steps along the way. That's the model that we're shooting for, and that will only occur if we take some risk.
Since its inception in the summer of 1949, the Air Force Medical Service has sought to provide service members and their families with first-rate health care and benefits anywhere at any time. Today, under the leadership of Lieutenant General Bruce Green, that mission has become Trusted Care Anywhere.
And so I looked for a mantra, and Trusted Care Anywhere was what I thought really fit what we do. In large part, the challenges to achieve Trusted Care Anywhere are to create a system that can be taken anywhere in the world and be just as useful, whether it's in war or in humanitarian assistance, and can create links back to the American standard of care, wherever that may be. And honestly, that's something that we can teach others to show better ways to interface. We always try to keep up in terms of maintaining the cutting edge in terms of our deployed medicine, our readiness mission. The secondary thing I would tell you is, in order to do that, I have the responsibility for training and equipping those medics so that they're ready to do that. And that involves trying to maintain state-of-the-art medicine back here at home. And no less than those two is the third mission, which is really to ensure a healthy force. And to do that, I have to basically leverage the very best in primary care to try and make certain that we are helping our beneficiaries stay healthy so that hopefully they don't need our assistance when they go overseas.
I spoke with Lieutenant General Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, about the central role AFMS plays in the most effective joint casualty care system in military history. A system that has saved thousands of lives that otherwise would have been lost on the battlefield.
The reality of our mission has always been for the Air Force to fly, fight, and win, and for the Air Force Medical Service to enable them to do that by creating health within our military force, and also to try and restore health whenever someone was injured in any way. And so, as you look at what our various missions have been, setting up hospitals and deploying our medics to somewhere far away, what's happened over the years is we've also picked up an air evacuation mission, which is a little broader than the Air Force, because we also use air evacuation to bring back casualties from all the services. And so I'd say that right now the Air Force Medical Service critical mission, in terms of what this country relies upon us for, is for the air evacuation.
General Green elaborates on his efforts to take this life-saving capability to the next level.
My newest challenge to our folks is in our modular expeditionary medical capabilities to be able to see the first patient in an hour of the time they arrive and to do the first surgery within 3 hours. Today, it takes us 12 to 24 hours to accomplish those things in setting up a hospital in a deployed setting. On the AirVac side, when you're bringing people home and having them back in the States in 3 days, it's a little tough to beat that. But we're finding there are certain classes of patients that we need to be cautious with to make sure we don't move them too early, that we make sure their staging stops are where they can get the right care so that we never cause any harm, and that honestly, for other patients, if there's a way to get them home to their families quicker by using things like polar routes and different types of transportation, we're trying to leverage that as well.
General Green describes the best way to accomplish his goals and achieve this vision.
From my perspective, I think you have to be very attuned to the people. I think that you have to know kind of where they're coming from. When you're looking for innovation in particular, you have to bring teams of very talented individuals together and listen to what they say, hopefully leveraging their experience to find new ways of doing things. I find that when you bring people together in an environment where they feel safe and can talk about those things that are a little different or they wish was different, that we can make kind of remarkable things happen. More often than not, I find that I create a common vision for folks. I get them to come in and share their ideas, and then I leverage the information that they share so that we can create something new. The reality in terms of trying to find new solutions is to get people to feel safe, to build trust, and then have everyone take pride in the final solution set that you're able to put out.
In 2009, the U.S. Postal Service collected, sorted, and delivered more than 177 billion pieces of mail. Finding more sustainable ways to process this mail and lower the Postal Service carbon footprint continues to be a central goal. Sam Palcrano, Vice President of Sustainability at the U.S. Postal Service, explains his leadership in forging sustainable operations.
My current position was established in May of 2008, and at the same time when I was announced, we announced the formation of the Office of Sustainability. What I'm responsible for is unifying and pulling together the Postal Service's sustainability efforts across all of the business units within our organization and across the organization as a whole. Our job is to coordinate, facilitate, and integrate activities across the business units to pull it all together, coordinate, tell our corporate story.
It's a corporate story that has as its backdrop a rich history of being a good steward of the environment.
We've always been a leader in using alternative fuel-capable vehicles and recycling in those arenas. In fact, we had the first electric vehicle. We tested that back in 1895, believe it or not, in Buffalo, New York. And we've been testing electric vehicles for almost 100 years now. Today, we have the largest alternative fuel-capable vehicle fleet in the world. And about 40,000 of those are ethanol fuel capable as well. But I think what's important is because of our size and because we touch every community, it's essential and we have an obligation to embrace green ways of doing business. And it's our objective as an organization to ultimately become known as a world-class sustainability leader. And we also are very focused on continuing to adopt sustainable ways of improving and doing our business to create a long-term value for our customers, our employees, and all of the communities that we serve. Corporately, we have a goal of reducing our facility energy 30% by 2015, our petroleum fuel use 20% by 2015, also increasing our alternative fuel use 10% by 2015, and we recently, last year, set our own corporate goal of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions 20% by 2020.
Going green may make good environmental sense. But how does going green and employing a formal sustainability program make good business sense? Sam Palcrano, Vice President of Sustainability at the U.S. Postal Service, explains why.
It's been related to the economic environment that the world is in right now. There's two very key areas that we've been focused on. First and foremost, of course, is can we find some new ways of growing revenue for the organization? So we've been exploring things like mailback opportunities. And by mailback, I mean we're piloting in 1,500 post offices, providing prepaid postage envelopes for people to mail back their small electronics, cell phones, PDAs, etc., where they get properly recycled. The other area, of course, that's of a significant importance to us is reducing our cost and being as efficient and lean as possible. Our mission is to provide universal service at affordable rates, so that helps us achieve that. And many of our green initiatives, we're focused on what we call no cost or low cost, but they impact the bottom line. So things like turning off the lights when they're not in use, turning off your computer monitors, adjusting the thermostats to required temperatures that we want in our particular facilities. We have a slogan. We call it reduce, reuse, and recycle. And it's becoming much more than just a slogan to us within the Postal Service. It's actually becoming a way of us doing our business.
As we continue to engage government executives outside the Beltway, I had the pleasure of speaking with Cass Holloway, Commissioner of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, about how his agency ensures the city's water system is viable for the next 100 years.
DEP is a utility. We are a water and wastewater utility primarily. There are a couple of other important quality of life functions that we handle and that are central to our mission, like air quality, noise quality, things that really are about the everyday environment and quality of life for New Yorkers. But the majority of our operating budget, our capital budget, our infrastructure, our personnel, the 6,000 people who work for the agency, that is about water supply and wastewater treatment. We supply about 1 billion gallons of drinking water every day to New Yorkers. So when I think about the agency operations, it's really supply, which comes from our 19 reservoirs, distribution, which are those 6,600 miles of water mains and 7,400 miles of sewer mains, and then treatment, the 14 wastewater treatment plants.
The infrastructure needed to provide 8 million people clean, healthy drinking water is quite amazing. And so are the many challenges in doing just that. Cass Holloway highlights a few of these challenges.
Number one is performance measurement at the agency. One of the things that we're building at DEP now is a new Office of Strategic Planning that is putting together a comprehensive set of metrics across those four core areas to help you drive decision making across the agency, because resources are limited. And in order to prioritize, you really have to have the whole picture. Challenge number two, our capital program is huge. We have right now $11 billion in construction. We have $3 billion in design. I think there is some opportunity to bring some more discipline to our project design and execution process. So that's a huge challenge. Third, operating efficiency. I think one thing that I saw coming into the agency, there was to a certain degree silos, operating silos that I wanted to break down. Part of the issue with it is people don't take advantage of resources. People also get it in their mind that those resources are their resources, and that's not the case. They're the agency's resources, and we have to figure out how best to allocate them. The final challenge, the agency's relationship with its regulators and our stakeholders. I think for a long time, the attitude was, well, you can only get something done with DEP if you sue us. The mayor's philosophy on that is, you know, if you're litigating, you've lost.
At the recent Best of the Best water taste test, New York City garnered second place. The city continues to excel in this area, supplying high-quality water from mountaintop to tap. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection, under the leadership of Cass Holloway, makes this all possible.
DEP clearly does a good job. People turn on the tap, the water comes out. The water also goes away, and it tastes great. So in a sense, we're doing great by that measure.
Whether it's delivering a precious natural resource like water, finding sustainable ways to operate, saving lives on the battlefield, or pursuing disruptive innovation in space exploration, the conversations shared in this edition of the Business of Government magazine have much to offer about leadership, government, and public service. Next up are Profiles in Leadership, when a special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Over the last 6 months, I've interviewed many government leaders who are changing the way government does business. Each joined us for an hour discussing critical issues facing their agencies. They are indeed profiles in leadership, and here's a glimpse. On a daily basis, 8,000 commercial and 18,000 private aircraft operate close to 50,000 flights per day in U.S. airspace. Doing this safely and efficiently involves the Federal Aviation Administration maintaining the world's largest air navigation and communication infrastructure, which relies significantly on advances in information technology. Here's Dave Bowen, Chief Information Officer at FAA, on the scope and importance of his agency's mission.
Which is quite simply to provide the safest air transportation in the world. And we think we do this extraordinarily well. We are running record low accident rates and have been for a number of years, and we continue to work to bring down those rates. The FAA basically regulates everything flying in a chunk of airspace, which basically covers 15% of the world's surface area. We operate in 24 million square miles of airspace, which includes the area over the continental United States, obviously Alaska, about halfway out over the Atlantic, and another 15 million miles of square miles of airspace out over almost the entire Pacific Ocean. In terms of budget, we're running about $16 billion in our total budget for the current fiscal year. The FAA has about 43,000 employees currently and 30,000 contractors. And in a given day across our entire landscape, we're seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60,000 flights per day.
How does the CIO support the mission of FAA? Dave Bowen explains.
Well, my role as the FAA's CIO is primarily to act as the primary advisor to the administrator on all IT matters. I'm responsible for all IT policy in the agency, and then I have areas of my operational department which focus on research and development, cybersecurity, oversight of our IT investments, oversight of our privacy initiatives, records, directives, a lot to do with our enterprise architecture and enterprise-wide initiatives.
Bowen identifies at least three top challenges facing the CIO at FAA.
The top three challenges, number one would be driving IT benefits and coordination of our IT operations inside of what we call a federated organization. Our lines of business in the FAA own and manage their own infrastructure, applications, things like that. And my role is to sort of coordinate those activities across the agency. A second area of focus, and this is my primary operational role in the agency, is that my department provides cybersecurity services to all the lines of business across the agency. And as you're probably aware, this is an ongoing challenge. It makes us drive toward deploying cybersecurity technology, drives us to closer linkages with federal agencies, and staying on top of our technology investments. The third area, it's an area that's growing in scope and importance, is oversight of our IT investments and reporting those up, making sure that things in our programs are on track.
Despite the recent economic downturn, forecast of future air travel demand remains high. The current air traffic control system is not scalable or flexible to keep up with the future demand. Dave Bowen, CIO at FAA, tells us more about their next-generation air transportation system, or NextGen.
NextGen does include a transition to satellite-based navigation and surveillance from facilities that are now ground-based. But it's far more than that. It's basically a transformation of our air management system. It impacts airspace and aircraft, procedures design, airport improvements, air-to-air communications, air-to-ground communications, weather integration, collision avoidance, new technology implementation, and even our air traffic control facilities. So it's very, very broad-ranging.
NextGen wouldn't have been possible without FAA being removed from the Government Accountability Office's high-risk list of government programs. Bowen is very proud of this significant accomplishment.
Well, we're really proud of that accomplishment, Michael. Our former administrator, Marion Blakey, decided some number of years ago that getting off the high-risk list was going to be a goal that we should shoot for at the FAA, and that it would provide evidence of our improvement in our program management efforts, which she felt was essential to give the Congress and the taxpayers confidence in our ability to deploy the next-gen programs as we moved into next-gen. So we took that on. My office put together a program of improvements based on past IG and GAO reports on all of our agency practices and programs in sort of the program management area. My old boss used to say, you need to inspect what you expect. And so I think that's pretty much the story here.
Information has such significant power, it can no longer be simply an enabler. The U.S. Navy is in the midst of evolving its information capabilities from 20th century supporting functions to core warfighting capability. It's about providing information to any device, anywhere, at any time. Giving the U.S. Navy information dominance, the capability to quickly identify, counter, and defeat threats. Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance and Director of Naval Intelligence, tells us more about the Navy's new approach to information as a main battery in its 21st century arsenal.
The Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Dominance was the brainchild of our Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead. He had several key initiatives dealing with information that he's implemented. The first one was to create a 3-star Director of Naval Intelligence. Subsequently, he combined that Director of Naval Intelligence with all other information capabilities under one umbrella. So the N2N6 deals with all elements of information, resources, policy, requirements on the Navy staff. The third item that he did was created an Information Dominance Corps, which is about 45,000 people strong in the Navy. And that organization manages, operates, is the functioning arm of Navy's information capabilities. And then the final, most significant element, I think, was he created the Fleet Cyber Command, or recommissioned the U.S. 10th Fleet, which has responsibility for cyber operations within the Navy. The CNO gave me his intent, and from his intent, I basically translated that into my strategic objective, which is to pioneer, field, and employ game-changing information capabilities that give information dominance over potential adversaries and decision superiority for U.S. commanders and operating forces.
More importantly, Admiral Dorsett is the principal advisor for all information capabilities to the Chief of Naval Operations.
I am the CNO's principal advisor for all information capabilities. So what is the future of the Navy's networks? Where are we going in terms of command and control? What is our architecture for our networks? How are we going to bring ships and aircraft to communicate together? How is information going to flow? Those are all in my portfolio in that portion of the job. My day-to-day activities, in addition to being his advisor, are for programming and resourcing the future Navy capabilities. So for acquiring equipment, ensuring there's money for training, ensuring that we've got the right organizational constructs for the flow of information across the Navy in very simple terms.
Though information has always had a tactical prominence in military execution, the proliferation of information technology and raw volumes of data has increased the value of information and analytics, reshaping the scope, pace, and character of war.
Back in the Civil War, Stonewall Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley Campaign in 1862 did a fantastic job of knowing the territory. He knew the geography. He also had a series of spies that kept track of the Union forces. So he had, in essence, in 1862, information dominance over the Union forces. Well, we're basically taking that very simple concept, and as you move into the information age, ensuring it's not just about geography, not just about oceanography for us, but all meteorological and oceanographic data and information, all information about the adversary, information about our own command and control capabilities and weapon systems, and bringing that together to have, we call it dominance over a potential adversary.
Vice Admiral Dorsett points out that the U.S. Navy is undertaking a significant transformation to better position itself for future operating environments, such as cyberspace. To do this requires agility, innovation, and the right organizational structure. As with any head-to-toe transformation, organizations face institutional barriers they must overcome in order to be successful.
I appreciate that question. It brings to mind a quote from Niccolo Machiavelli, who is a 16th century Italian philosopher and political scientist. Machiavelli said, "There's nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things." And how true that is, because this creation of information dominance focus within the Navy is truly a revolutionary idea and concept, I think, for the Navy, something that we've been toying with along the way. But it took Admiral Ruffhead and his leadership to bring it all to bear and move boldly in this arena.
The Obama administration has challenged federal agencies to become more transparent, participatory, and collaborative. And the U.S. General Services Administration plays a critical role in making such aspirations real. Dr. David McClure, Associate Administrator of the Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies at GSA, provides some context.
This is one of the most important areas for the Obama administration. The president, within 24 hours of office, signed a presidential directive on creating openness and transparency in government. The open government movement is about increasing transparency in government, making itself visible to the average citizen in terms of its operations, its activities, its results. It's about participation, opening up the channels of participation so that citizens can actually interact in a two-way manner with government. It's not a one-way feed of information from government to citizens. Collaboration is another principle of open government, that you allow issues to be brought up, discussed, challenges issued, and some collaboration, some decision-making that's again, in an open, participatory fashion and could perhaps be tailored for different kinds of needs. And the last real principle, I think, of open government is innovation. It's about not standing still. It's about thinking about new ways that you could direct the activities and processes of government to be as innovative as possible, not to go out into unnecessary risk, but be creative, open up for new ideas and new ways of conducting the business of government. And those cornerstones lie behind, I think, everything you see coming out of the White House.
So what does this call for more open government really mean for federal agencies, and what can citizens expect? Here's David McClure.
It has some core fundamental things that agencies are expected to do. One is, in the area of transparency, to post or publish high-value data sets. This is a push to get information that has historically been either inaccessible or locked up in government to be put out in the sunshine for everyone to see. Number one is just getting data into the public domain. You've seen USAspending.gov created. It gives you a complete overview of the financial situation of government. You see data.gov that's been created, which has hundreds of thousands of data sets that are posted for people to use. The second big piece is openness, and that's creating opportunities for the public to do this interaction. And that's largely being done through the new media or social media tools that we are putting in place. So running open public dialogues where you can interact with government, give ideas, vote on things, react to what other citizens are bringing up and saying that's a great idea, and then taking that interaction to improve service delivery or the public face of your agency or opportunities to deliver services in different ways that you weren't aware that perhaps the customer base needed. The third piece that's going in place are what we call contests and challenges, and I think this is the really fun piece of open government. It's a fundamental recognition that the best ideas of how to do anything never reside within any single unit, office, or person. We're setting up challenges and contests to allow citizens and organized groups to actually come up with new proposals on how government could deliver a service or build a new way to organize and use information or actually develop a product. Product that's delivered becomes government property. It's a fascinating and quite different model than everything going through a competitive procurement and acquisition model. And it's groundbreaking, and not everything is suited for this, but I think some things are.
McClure recognizes that the success of open government initiatives rests on transforming culture and having the right people with the right skills leading in the right direction.
It's not a technology issue. It's really understanding, what am I really trying to engage or collaborate about, and then making decisions about the best way to make that happen.
In the midst of its 7th anniversary, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued its first ever quadrennial review that delineates 5 mission priority areas. Here's Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at DHS.
The department earlier this year completed the quadrennial Homeland Security Review. And as part of that review, decided that it's really focused on 5 mission areas. And just let me very quickly go through those. Mission area 1 is preventing terrorism and enhancing security of the country. 2, securing and managing our borders. 3, enforcing and administering our immigration laws. 4, safeguarding and securing cyberspace. And then the 5th is ensuring resilience to disasters. What I have found amazing in my 1 year here is just the, as you can imagine, the breadth and diversity of what that entails to carry out those five mission spaces. The scope and scale of the organization, quite large, 200,000 employees plus, quite a few different mission sets from the standpoint that we actually have 22 individual operating organizations that carry out those five missions that I alluded to before. Not all of them have their own ID departments. Many of the smaller ones are actually served by my organization directly. But most of them have IT organizations. Some of them have designated CIOs. And those CIOs have a dotted line responsibility to myself, where I have the overarching responsibility and authority over the whole IT function for DHS.
Spires explains why he took this role at DHS.
The reason I'm the CIO here and accepted the position is because I believe IT is a foundational and critical element to the success of an organization such as Homeland Security. In fact, I would say that it is as important as any function in assuring mission effectiveness today.
What are some of the challenges facing DHS's CIO? Richard Spires identifies his top four.
Spent about 3 months or so really assessing where I thought the organization was in its use of IT and how we were managing IT overall throughout DHS. First, we need to improve how we manage, particularly our largest IT investments. But overall, I would say we're just not managing many of these investments as well as we need to. And so this whole area of both program reviews, essentially my version of the tech stats that Vivek Kundra has done, based on those, there's been significant changes to some programs based on those reviews. But going forward, it's really about institutionalizing, if you will, best practices and really working to make sure that the proper governance and oversight exists for these programs and the proper disciplines are being implemented in these programs to manage them effectively and that we have them properly staffed. Number two is really the infrastructure layer. We have the data center consolidation initiative within the Department of Homeland Security, our OneNet initiative to bring together one physical network infrastructure. There's other things we're doing. We're rolling out things like rationalizing our Active Directory structure, our email as a service offering. There's a number of things we're doing at an enterprise level that we need to get done. The third area is kind of an interesting one, and I think goes to the heart of really trying to be one DHS, as the Secretary has discussed. While we're one department, too often we still operate as up to 22 different component organizations. We just need to be collaborating in much better ways. And so this idea of doing a cross-cutting governance model where we're looking at things from a function or portfolio perspective that cross-cut the components, I think is very critical to get to one DHS, and it's something that I'm pushing very hard on. Can't get any of this done without a really good staff. We need to have a strong government employee base within our IT functions to make this work.
Spires is driving a governance model that helps DHS define where there's leverage potential across the enterprise. It's about eliminating duplication and using IT capabilities that may be thriving in one component that are applicable to others.
So bringing those together and being able to get that kind of synergy in something like IT requires a collaborative effort, and that's where governance comes in, okay? So I'm a huge believer, if you can get the right people at the right level around the table with a shared sense of mission or outcome, you really can drive some amazing things.
Next up, our forum, when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. How is the federal government leveraging award prizes to spur innovation and solve tough problems? Pick up the latest Senate report, Managing Innovation Prizes in Government, and find out. Drawing on such successful efforts like the Lunar Lander Challenge and DARPA's Grand Urban Challenges, this report offers practical insights and recommendations for the design, implementation, and evaluation of innovation prizes in government. you can order or download a free copy of Managing Innovation Prizes in Government and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Telework has been touted as a winning strategy for government. In fact, a study by the Telework Research Network claims potential savings of nearly $3.8 billion. In a recent IBM Center report, Implementing Telework, Lessons Learned for Four Federal Agencies, Professor Scott Obermeyer presents case studies of federal agencies who have successfully implemented telework in their organizations. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. The forum in this edition of the Business of Government magazine tackles many of the pressing issues facing governments at all levels, but most particularly the federal government's estimated annual structural budget deficit of $500 to $700 billion. The first contribution to this forum seeks to dispel belief in business as usual, outlining specific strategies government can take to cut costs and improve performance. It posits that the federal government must adopt an aggressive spending reduction program that includes reforming entitlements, eliminating low-priority programs, and adopting commercial best practices. Here's Jonathan Bruhl, Executive Director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government, on the nature of this challenge.
We're operating following the worst recession since the 1930s, and the steep decline in first federal revenues, and particularly at the state level in tax receipts, and federal agencies are going to continue to face large budget gaps. So there's an urgent need to reduce and eliminate these deficits as soon as possible. And the key is to find ways to redesign how programs operate and deliver their services.
What about adopting commercial best practices in government operations? Jonathan Bruhl continues.
The situation is that while at the national level, entitlement reform and elimination of low-priority programs will be a critical component of deficit reduction strategies, there's a huge opportunity for adopting commercial best practices and huge opportunity for those to lead to significant savings in federal, state, and local government operating costs. And the key here is that such practices have already been adopted to help commercial organizations save money while becoming more competitive, especially while doing more with less.
He highlights a few strategies.
Well, the big challenge in many respects is turning ideas into action. Identifying the sources of savings is the easy part. Large organizations struggle with changing their ways. And as we all know, government, whether it's federal, state, or local, consists of quite disparate enterprises that have traditionally found it difficult to make significant changes in their operations. But the good news, as this forum points out, is that there are cost-saving strategies that do not require legislative approval and that are based on proven, realistic lessons from the private sector and other governmental organizations.
What needs to happen next? Here's Jonathan Bruhl.
Based on industry experience, it's possible to achieve savings while at the same time improving service and performance. We've seen it in industry after industry, and we've seen it in various companies' transformations. Governments can adopt a long-term spending strategy that's structurally sustainable and has a combination of innovative, technology-fueled efficiency. The reliance on commercial best practices with proven, realistic strategies at the center of such efforts.
Along with this timely forum topic, this edition of the Business of Government magazine also offers compelling viewpoints from a variety of thought leaders. Using new technologies more effectively is among the key priorities for organizations today. Here's Dan Chanock, senior fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, giving his viewpoint on innovation that matters.
So in the government today, more than ever before, the pace of technology and the pace of innovation matters a lot to how successful a manager or an executive could be. And that's irrespective of the job that they're in. So traditionally, government managers have thought about technology and innovation as the domain of chief information officers, or more recently, chief technology officers. The reason that I thought this piece was relevant to a consideration of how government managers of all kinds can be successful is that more than ever before, technology really can mean the make or break in terms of a government program and a government program manager achieving its goals for success. And not all program managers, in fact, probably a majority of program managers, have really thought about how to leverage the power of technology for their own purposes. These are some practical steps that managers can take to think about how they can leverage innovation to make their programs more effective and to enable them to be more effective as executives.
Looking down the technology road, here's what Dan Jenick sees.
It starts with the mission, and it then quickly goes to how do you use technology and innovation to support achieving mission goals and objectives more effectively. So if you think about cloud computing, which is a current term of art for basically using a computing that doesn't sit in a server that you own in your agency, but may sit elsewhere, and you basically tap into it from your machine, the bottom line is that it takes a lot less money and can be much more effective in reaching multiple areas to use cloud computing approaches than to use traditional approaches, where innovation, in this case distributed technologies like cloud computing, can help them save money, can help them to achieve their mission more effectively. Everybody is familiar now with social media, and those technologies are very powerful and will become more powerful in creating groups of people that are interested in a similar subject matter. So you're looking down the road and seeing, well, where are social media technologies going? How can I use them to reach my constituents, the stakeholders, the beneficiaries that benefit from my program? Understanding how to leverage social media technologies is going to make you as a manager or you as a government executive much more effective in reaching the people that depend on your program.
What about linking stakeholders to benefits? Here's Dan Jenick.
Well, really, the idea behind reaching out to stakeholders is having them understand what the technology can do to help them and how their view can really help the government more effectively. What technology and innovation can do is involve the stakeholders at the first step of that process so that they can, again, coming back to the social media example, and there are examples within the government of where this is happening now, especially at the General Services Administration's Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies, where they're using different types of technology platforms or ways that citizens can interact with the government through technology, through the Internet, to get information in about what people think about the benefits that they'd like to see from programs at the first part of a program design process. So once they identify what the benefits are from the stakeholders' perspective and then come up with a set of technology or programmatic activities to achieve those benefits, they can go back out to the stakeholders and say, hey, we're going to try these three things. What do you think? And then they can refine those three things based on the feedback from stakeholders. So it involves a much more agile or a much more interactive set of discussions with stakeholders than has ever been achieved before, and again makes managers and executives more effective in their job at serving stakeholders through the programs that they operate.
Do you need to confront risks directly?
Change is hard. One of the biggest risks of change is that people are often for good reasons associated with current processes, which tend to work sometimes very well, sometimes somewhat well, sometimes not well. But they're still the process that they know and are familiar with. And getting people to understand that the power that technology and that innovation can have to help them achieve greater impact through their programs is something that might unsettle other individuals who have a vested interest in the status quo. So this isn't just about understanding technology and understanding how to make technology work for a particular program in terms of communications with stakeholders. It's also about reaching across to the various communities that are affected by that program and bringing them into the fold. So the most successful government manager will reach out to all of the affected parties in a program and bring them together to understand, all right, we're going to take a new approach to communicating with the citizens who might be the beneficiaries of our program. This is going to require change from all of us. Here are the benefits that we can achieve and that will minimize any risk that you might see right now from changing the status quo in new directions. There are other ways to overcome risk, and one is to look at new voices who technology can bring in to overcome some inertia. For example, the Gov2O community has been able to reach out to new voices in different types of government programs, for example, from the academic community, from the research community. There's always a bit of risk in increasing the level of conversation, meaning that the more voices you bring in, the more dissenting voices have an opportunity to weigh in. But in the long run, I think that managers and executives in the government will be more successful for having reached out to those entities and, by and large, been able to get success in terms of having them accept and understand the results and decisions of programs. This is especially true in the regulatory area. For example, electronic rulemaking is all about using technology to expand the conversation around inputs to make government decisions better and accepted more widely by the regulated public.
Stay tuned as we wrap up this edition of the Business of Government magazine. The Open Government Directive called upon each federal agency to formulate a plan for how it intended to increase openness and public engagement in its programs and operations. The latest Senate report, An Open Government Implementation Model, Moving to Increase Public Engagement, provides a roadmap federal agencies can use to guide their efforts. You can order or download a free copy of this and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Senate report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. The U.S. workplace is undergoing a significant transition that presents uncharted territory and tremendous opportunity. The latest Senate report, Engaging a Multi-Generational Workforce, Practical Advice for Government Managers, examines six trends now occurring in the workplace and describes how leaders can successfully manage through these trends and their challenges. These are the challenges of leading a multi-generational workforce and is increasingly driven by rapid technological changes that have changed the nature of work and how it gets done. You can order or download a free copy of this report and all Senate reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. During the last few months, I've had an opportunity to speak with many public servants who are pursuing innovative approaches to achieving their missions and serving citizens. Clarence Carter, director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services, offers insights on human service delivery and his efforts to put those in need at the center.
The construct of the existing human services system is one that is an aggregation of individual categorical programs that were all meant to address some aspect of the human condition. We think of them euphemistically, we call it the social safety net. Well, quite frankly, it's very much a misnomer because they're not knitted together at all. It is an aggregation of individual programs that literally don't work together to be able to take a comprehensive approach to enhancing the human condition. So the silos is the first problem that we have. The second problem is that the system that we administer is what we call program-centric. We measure the effectiveness on goals which are related to the program. It's my argument that we should be focusing on human well-being and not what's important to the program. And the third problem in the existing construct is that the system was not built around an exit strategy. It was built really around a maintenance strategy. As long as you meet the criterion to receive a particular benefit, good, or service, and there are resources to provide that service, you will receive it. And it's my argument that our system should be focused on trying to move as many people through it as is possible, as quickly as possible, because we don't really want the members of our society in a position where they have to come to government for their basic subsistence. And so it's those three things to me that create a construct which really is not about growing human capacity, but it is really about the administration of an aggregation of programs that really maintain human dysfunction. In a person-first or person-centric system, Our effectiveness should be judged on the degree to which we enhance the human condition, not simply provide units of service for people who are in need. For us, it is a fundamentally different construct. If we focus on the individual, grow the capacity of that individual to be as self-sufficient as possible, we strengthen not only that individual or that family, but we strengthen our society.
How does